The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Cynical listeners, Kaiser here. Before we get started, just a couple of things. First, we've got a very cool event coming up for those of you who are going to be in the Boston area on the evening of Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m., I imagine that some of you are going to be in Cambridge then for the Harvard-China Forum, so while you're there, head up to MIT, where we're going to be doing a Seneca and GGV combined live show with Hans Tung and Zara Zhang from GGV Capital. They are, of course, the two hosts of the GGV 996 podcast on cross-border technology, on investment, on entrepreneurship. I have the pleasure of producing that show, and we are now going into crossover mode. I'm going to interview Hans about his incredibly fascinating experience as a tech investor. And then Zara, Hans, and I are all going to speak with Yasheng Huang, professor of global economics and management at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He is a renowned economist, very, very smart analyst on the state of U.S.-China relations and other things. You've heard him on the show before, I hope. This event is going to be free and is open to all. The show will be at 7 p.m. on Saturday, April 7th at MIT. Space is limited, and the specific location will be included in the confirmation email that we'll send you if you register, so do register. Register soon at 996.ggvc.com/live. Again, that's 996.ggvc.com/live. The other thing, this show that you're about to hear was recorded on March 24th, which was before we learned of Kim Jong-un's trip to Beijing, and so some of the comments of the guests might not reflect their current thinking post-Kim visit, just so you know. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's free daily email newsletter, or better still, sign up for our SubChina Access membership to receive discounts or free admission to events, early releases of podcasts, including this one, premium content, and perhaps best of all, join our community of listeners and readers in our lively Slack channel, where you can chat with our editorial team and with special guests we bring on. Visit our website at subchina.com for a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the sidelines of the Association for Asian Studies Conference in Washington, D.C. Co-host Jeremy Goldkorn is on holiday, so it's just me today. Historical memory has been a recurrent theme on this show, and in fact, just yesterday I spoke with Orville Schell about that topic, looking at the way that China's party leadership controls, manipulates, and sometimes even just erases history in the service of contemporary political exigencies. So today we're going to talk about that topic when it comes to China's relationship with North Korea and catch up a little bit on the state of China DPRK in this current time of crisis. Joining me today are two scholars of China and North Korea. Ma Zhao is Associate Professor of Modern Chinese History and Culture at Washington University in St. Louis. Ma Zhao is the author of Runaway Wives, Urban Crimes and Survival Tactics in Wartime Beijing, 1937 to 1949, and is working on a new book entitled Seditious Voices in Revolutionary China, 1950 to 1953. He's recently written an excellent paper that examines how a documentary series about the Korean War produced in China for the 60th anniversary of the armistice reflects the shifting relationship between China and its problematic ally. He appears frequently in commercial Chinese media and state-run U.S. media. Ma Zhao, welcome to Seneca.
Well, thank you, Kaiser, for having me.
You're very welcome. We're also joined by John DeLurie, who's been something of a go-to for many media outlets seeking commentary on North Korea. He insists this is just because of time zones and his ability to speak, you know, native English. Anyway, but actually his insights have been terrific in helping us all understand the unfolding North Korea crisis. So John is Associate Professor of Chinese Studies at Yonsei University in South Korea and is co-author, along with Orville Schell, the aforementioned Orville Schell, of one of the books that I recommend to anyone who asks for a good book recommendation to understand how China's history reshapes its current worldview. That book is, of course, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. Yesterday we had wealth, today it's power, right?
I'll take that.
Okay. Unbelievably, yesterday was the first time I actually met John, although we've communicated before, so it was great to meet you, man.
It's really good to meet you at last, Kaiser.
And welcome at last to Seneca. So we're going to focus, like I said, on the historical relationship between China and North Korea. But before we do that, let's actually start with the current state of things. Late last week, at the time of recording anyway, President Trump announced Section 301 tariffs on some $60 billion of Chinese goods, after which China announced some initial and still modest retaliation, but the very same day, Thursday, H.R. McMaster's resignation as National Security Advisor was announced, and he's going to be replaced by former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, the mustache of Armageddon, someone who's known to be quite hawkish on Iran and on, of course, North Korea, and all this just weeks after Trump's surprising ad hoc acceptance of an in-person meeting with Kim Jong-un. Something that had just been, put forward kind of as what was thought to be a non-starter in meetings between DPRK and South Korea. So let's start with you, John.
Yeah.
With U.S.-China relations getting increasingly frosty and with apparently more possibility of actual direct bilateral talks between North Korea and the U.S., where does this leave China?
Yeah, well, if we look back in the last year and the way that Trump framed U.S.-China relations, North Korea was right at the middle of that, right? And basically, Trump made this deal very explicit. I care about two things, China. I care about North Korea and trade. And if you give me North Korea, if you're harsher and harsher on North Korea, then you sort of get trade. I'm going to lay off trade. Not to mention all the other things in the relationship, right, are now all second or third tier.
Right.
So, I mean, my reading of it is that was a great year for Xi. Because he was, for various reasons we may get into, I'm sure we will, he was happy to increase that pressure on North Korea. And so it won him a very good year of U.S.-China relations. But by the same token, now we could be moving into a very different configuration.
Sure.
Because if Trump works out this North Korea thing, sort of along with the South Koreans, and we move into a diplomacy and progress, suddenly that framework is gone, right?
Yeah.
And Trump doesn't need Xi on North Korea. And indeed, the move on trade could be related to the fact that he doesn't need China and North Korea in the same way as before. So it really shakes up the whole framework. And so I would guess that the Chinese are scrambling a bit right now to figure out sort of what does this mean? So anyway, I think that's kind of where we are in terms of the policy. With the people, we can get into that too, but that may be a slightly different story.
So China, of course, has a relationship with the ROK as well as with the DPRK. And, of course, there was a deep freeze in PRC-South Korea relations that began with the initial deployment of THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. Things have thawed a bit. And the Korean boy bands that, decorate my daughter's room are no longer shunned, I guess, in the mainland. Thank God. So Majal, help us puzzle through the whole, the remaining complexities of this polygon that we've...
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm a historian by training, but sometimes when you do the North Korean history, and so this current affairs always pop up on your desk.
Yeah.
So for the recent up and down and the recent development of Trump and Kim Jong-un romance, I think I have two points to make. One is, first of all, the question is, has China ever played any decisive role in North Korean foreign policy? Because, the reason why I'm asking the question is because here's the notion that China and North Korea, they are allies.
Right.
And so that's why we expect China playing a very major role in North Korean's foreign policy. But the problem is China withdraw, 1956, so North Korea basically purged the whole faction of pro-China, this senior leadership in their own party. And then 1958, So the People's Volunteer Army withdraw from North Korea.
Right.
And ever since that, I would say that not any single major foreign power has any meaningful relationship or meaningful impact in North Korean foreign policy.
Right, after all, the doctrine of self-reliance. Right.
Right. I mean, so that's something we need to keep in mind. And the second one is, I don't think China will be just marginalized because China is always there. And also the prospect of this talk, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, is so uncertain because, I mean, the core issue is security, and we don't think the security thing can be easily resolved. And the second one is the trust, you know, and how much each party will trust the other. And so without resolving security issues and no trust between from North Korea and vis-a-vis United States, and I think China will play some role over there, not central, not decisive, but it won't be marginalized.
Do you think that it's impacted at all by the warming of relations with the ROK these days?
Well, I think it's getting better. Mm-hmm. And so, but again, the ultimately, this is going to be resolved between two powers, United States and China. And so South Korea, they can do something, but not necessarily can change the whole game. This is my view. Maybe John has a different take.
No, I mean, that thing is interesting, right? Because if we zoom out a little bit, during the whole period, the kind of pivot to Asia period, when U.S. policy was looking for strengthening its alliances, picking up new ones, you know, getting in Vietnam, port calls and all this stuff going on. You have many countries in Asia, not all of them, but many who were eagerly seeking this out with the United States, right? South Korea was not one of those countries.
No.
I mean, it has an alliance and it was fulfilling all that. But it was during that period, if you recall, the Park Geun-hye, the early years, where the South Korea-China relationship probably reached a certain kind of peak.
Sure.
Economically, I mean, they were closing in on $300 billion. They were moving up to $300 billion in trade volume. You remember when the South Korean president stood on Tiananmen Square, you know, it was like Xi Jinping and Putin and Park Geun-hye,
right?
And the North Korean guy was in the back row, you know, way off trying to stay out of the photo. So that's a really interesting moment of this of the South Korea China piece getting much closer together. And then it fell apart over THAAD. I'm not too surprised with what we're seeing now, which is even though Xi made a big stink about THAAD, and they pushed it quite hard, you know, and they did economic bullying and they did these sort of de facto sanctions and all that. But essentially what we're seeing now is with the new president, with Moon, who sent clear signals, I want to restore like a good relationship with China. But I think Moon basically said to Xi, I mean, look at what's going on, right? Kim is launching a missile like every other week.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I'm myself maybe ambivalent about THAAD, my public's so clear about this. The world's kind of so clear. So we're going to have to improve despite the existence of this battery.
Right.
And the
reason that I ask is I feel like this is a piece of the puzzle that is often very much overlooked in mm-hmm. the U.S. I mean, in our own, we don't look at this relationship between South Korea and China as much as we probably ought to.
I agree. There's very little attention paid to it. And it's, you know, since I'm living over there, it's been 8 years. And as a China expert, I mean, it's really nuanced. You know, it's in its own way more complicated at this point than the China-North Korea relationship,
right?
You know, because South Korea has this strong alliance with the United States, committed to that. But it's a country that really wants a good relationship with China, you know? And so they're every day kind of navigating that.
And also you have to think about this domestic dynamic in the South Korea's internal politics,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
this is the president coming from a party historically supports in a reconciliation and in a close relationship with North Korea. And so if the talk and it doesn't deliver the, you know, his promise or fulfill the promise, and so that might be something different.
Yeah, he faces an unhappy electorate at home. So, I mean, what we really want to do, though, with the rest of this podcast is look historically at things that, I mean, have, you know, very strong bearing on the state of relations today. So let's start off maybe by sketching a brief outline history of the relationship between North Korea and China since the outbreak of the war, and maybe try to periodize it. I mean, Majal got a start on this, talking about what had happened after 1956 with the expulsion, basically, of the entire faction of the Workers' Party that was pro-China. That's right. I actually just had the pleasure of attending a panel on which both of you presented. Majal, you've been interested in explaining how the early PRC propaganda machine mm-hmm. actually sold the very idea of supporting Korea to ordinary Chinese people who, in the year 1950, still had, you know, a very bad impression of Koreans. Can you talk about, first of all, what attitudes toward Korea were mm-hmm. like in the general populace of China and within the Chinese Communist Party at the time, and tell us how the party managed to persuade people to sort of rehabilitate the image and promote internationalism. Mm-hmm.
I think this is a good question because when we think about this China-North Korean alliance, usually we go back to the moment when this alliance was forged, which is the wartime, you know, 1950. But actually, there's more than that. And because historically, this is a two country, I mean, they share this pretty much same part of the neighborhood and the community over there. So from early 20th century and all the way down to the Korean War, and there's a lot of sort of baggage in the relationship between these two countries. In my research, I show that there's a significant amount of anti-Korean sentiments at the time of the war started in 1950. You know, that sentiments goes into China's traumatic experience in the early 20th century when China was not just only victimized by the industrial powers, you know, European countries and Japan, but also by countries that used to be part of the Chinese tributary empire. So Korea is a good example because up until 1894, 1895, the First Sino-Japanese War, Korea was a part of, and within Chinese imperial orbit, right? And so, but after that, Korea was colonized by Japanese Empire, and so that really overturned this entire geopolitical relationship in East Asia. So no longer China on the top, and then Korea and Japan, but now we see it's Japan on the top, and then Korea as a colony, as a second tier country, and then it's the China's occupied territory. So what the Koreans did in the Chinese in the Japanese occupied territory in China, I mean, they run drug syndicates and they run drug empires, and so it involved all kinds of crime, especially in North China. So when we get down to the Korean War, that part of historical memory continues and it continues to haunt people's memory.
Is there a role in crime and in drugs and prostitution? So is this pretty well attested? Is this? I mean, I've not really heard much about that. I mean, it rises above just sort of rumor the way, say, we talk about maybe West Africans in Beijing today? Or
no, well, actually, it's well documented. And okay. Because we see, if you go to the Beijing Municipal Archives, where I did my archival research, and you do this North Korean, just put in the Korean and do the keyword search, and it will come up at least hundreds of documents talking about, they were done by the Beijing Municipal Police before 1949. And so, documenting all kinds of criminal activities Koreans engaged. And just to give you one quick example, in 1939, and the Beijing Municipal Police, they identified 449 Korean drug dealers inside operating in Beijing.
Just
so
in the city,
that's
Beijing.
In the big that's in the big number, for
we're talking about opium, right?
All kinds of, and it's just primarily opium and heroin, and so just kind of narcotics. But again, think about this: drug is just part of the this underworld of criminality. So there's other things involved as well.
So they're still at it with the meth now, but so how? I mean, the other part of my question was how did they rehabilitate that image?
Oh, yes. So that's why this became a daunting task for the communist propaganda campaign at war, to talk about how you understand why China should kind of spill their blood and to support this ally. They do this in two ways. One is they say this is internationalism we are talking about today because, China is after liberating its own country. So China is going for international stage. And so Korea is the valuable Cold War ally for China. So, for this global vision, global mission. So, Korea is our legitimate ally. And also the second one is they do this class analysis. Basically say, we have revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries, just like we have in China. So the revolutionaries in North Korea, revolutionaries in Korea, and they are now all in North Korea.
Right.
And so this anti-revolutionary, they're all in South. So that's an easy way for them to talk about, how you identify your ally and your enemy.
Huh. And we are going to be talking about how they then tried to strip out the internationalism content and the export of revolution in when we move further on and talk about this paper that you've written. John, in the years immediately following the armistice, I suppose most people probably assume that the relationship between the wartime allies stayed pretty tight. But as Rajal just said, in 1956, there were some pretty big changes. 53 was the year that Stalin died, and then de-Stalinization would begin in earnest a few years later with Khrushchev and his secret speech and so forth. Was this the event that changed things in 56, or did this have nothing to do with a warming tie between the Soviet Union and Korea? In other words, was the incipient Sino-Soviet split part of the reason for these incipient, maybe North Korean-Chinese split?
56 is a really, really critical moment, interesting moment. I think that's too early. I think we're getting teleologically ahead of ourselves to read back the Sino-Soviet split. I think it's best understood in a domestic politics of North Korea context, where Kim Il-sung, I mean, keep in mind, the guy is very young. You know, he's got a good pedigree because he was a partisan. He did fight. He was on the good side, you know, the communists fighting against the Japanese as part of a basically Chinese Red Army. And then some years in the Soviet Union, we're not 100% sure if he was in jail or to some extent serving with the Soviet forces. But anyway, the Soviets back him and they bring him in. They put him in power. He's a very young guy, you know, early 30s. You know, I think it's fair to say, especially then, Korea is a very Confucian society. You know, I mean, the elder, the notion of a leader should be an older person. And so here's this young kid, really, right, who has to establish himself. He's got the backings of Moscow, and so that gives him that first position. But through the war, there are purges right after, in stages, late stages of the war, after the war, and 56 is kind of a really big one. But Kim Il-sung has to consolidate his power. I mean, I think that stuff is relevant to understanding his grandson,
sure,
you know, in the last 6 years of power. So in 56, if we think about the Sino-Soviet dimension, he pushes out not just the so-called Yan'an faction. Uh-huh. He also pushes out the Moscow faction.
Right?
And in fact, it's very interesting. Beijing and Moscow have a dual intervention where they send envoys. Peng Dehuai comes from China.
Mm-hmm.
Senior envoys coordinated. Moscow and Beijing go in and tell young Kim, hey, don't go too far with this purge thing. And so he sort of backs off and then he completes it and he pushes them out. So it's a different dynamic. I mean, in a way, it's kind of the last stages of watching the Soviets and the Chinese kind of work together to try and manage the North Korea issue.
Before the
And he pushes back against both of them later. Especially from, I mean, I think the clearest moment you can see it is 1961, where a very important year, especially insofar as Kim Il-sung signs a treaty with the Soviet Union, a defense treaty with the Soviet Union. And then he keeps going. He takes the train from Moscow to Beijing and signs a treaty with Mao.
Okay.
So the current treaty is a 1961 treaty.
That's right.
The Russians got rid of it, but the Chinese still abide by it. So by 61, everyone knows the Sino-Soviet split, obviously, as well there. So that's where we see... You know, Kim Il-sung becomes really a master of manipulating the schism within the communist bloc.
Let's talk about how he manipulated the schism. Did he play Moscow and Beijing off against one another? What was the period of the 1960s like?
Well, again, here we need to think about, because when we talk about the socialist bloc during the Cold War, and we tend to emphasize the how close North Korea is a part of the socialist empire, the socialist camp. But at the same time, you know, again, think about this is a guy and this is the revolution coming out of a very strong nationalist sentiment. And so that's why on the one hand, yes, they receive an aid and they receive military supplies from all the socialist brothers. But at the same time, you know, for Kim Il-sung, and not just the consolidating his power by purging all this pro-Russian and pro-Chinese factions, but also just giving one example, you know, he even managed his economy and not participating in the socialist economic cooperation that kind of system, and they even calculated his own 7-year plan in a different schedule and just trying to avoid, you know, being messed up by the socialist allies. And so that's just giving a sense of, you know, he is really think about and how to be independent, you know, before these two communist giants.
So let's fast forward a little bit to the dawn of reform and opening. Your paper, John, on political succession in the Kim dynasty looks at the strain on the relationship at around that time when a dynastic succession was happening in Pyongyang at precisely the moment when Deng was attacking the very idea of lifelong leadership, which is ironic today, as you correctly noted, that saying that it was quintessentially feudal, right? It was Feng Jian. Anyway, how did North Korea at that time view so that was great, I mean, and we can talk about that some other time, but how did North Korea at that time view the changes that were already underway in its larger neighbor? Did they see Deng as having sold out the revolution, playing footsie with the U.S. as he had all through, I mean, as Mao and Zhou Enlai started to do, but you know, by 1980, they had been arming the Mujahideen, and they had listening stations for the U.S. CIA in Western China, and you know, they were very much in bed with the U.S. in as part of the Strategic Triangle. Yeah,
All right, so since this is a podcast, I'm going to go out on some historical limbs here.
Go for
all right,
it.
But Manchao, don't report this to any of the academic authorities. Because, I mean, your question requires us to speculate, me to speculate a little bit beyond where the evidence stops.
Sure.
But especially dealing with North Korea, that's kind of, if you want to say anything, you know, you have to take some of these speculative moves. So I think it's very interesting, your question, you know, and if we put ourselves sort of in Kim Il-sung's shoes, right? When Mao dies in 76, go back, when Stalin dies in 53, Mao now says, I'm Lao Da, I'm the big, you know, I'm the head of the whole show, right? And that's a big part of the problem with Khrushchev is like Mao doesn't accept it. He thinks now he's... Well, when Mao dies in 76, guess who maybe thinks now he's the Lao Da, you know, is Kim Il-sung. And I think this question of Kim Il-sung, Deng Xiaoping, I think their relationship, I mean, it's kind of fascinating me to try and piece it together, you know. So let me give you one example. In 78, Hua Guofeng visits in May. And from what I've been able to collect, it's a full-on extravaganza. It's a love fest, you know, 4 or 5 day trip. You see Kim Il-sung and Hua Guofeng going to all these events together, and it's a big sort of, you know.
They deserve each other.
Yeah. So in September, Deng Xiaoping visits. It's quite interesting. Two in a year, right? Spring and fall. And there's this one image that just kind of fascinates me. It's just a still. It's Deng Xiaoping at the airport. Kim Il-sung's not there to greet him on the tarmac. And it's Deng walking in front of a huge picture, two huge portraits of Kim Il-sung and Hua Guofeng.
Wow.
You know? And it's kind of like, you're Deng Xiaoping, you know? Sort of,
remind
how does this
you
whole
you
thing
are.
Feel? Yeah. So I think there's a lot of tensions going on. And then as far as what we look back and everyone celebrates, you know, Gai Ge Kai Fang, they're not using the term yet, but Deng already, you know, has the whole vision in mind. And I don't know, I think you're Kim Il-sung at that period. North Korea's still doing okay, you know? The gap is not exploded yet with the South. Militarily, they're at about parity with South Korea. Kim Il-sung may have gotten some ideas about wanting to reunify because he saw what just happened in Vietnam. And you're looking at Deng and you don't know the future that China's going to run circles around you economically.
Uh-huh.
I think there's an arrogance, you know, on Kim Il-sung's part. And imagine how infuriating that is when you're Deng Xiaoping. So
already the lips and teeth are not quite in contact.
Sort of chattering in the cold. Right. Now that, again, that was speculative history we just indulged in.
Okay, the most fun kind. We have still a lot of history to move through before we get to, you know, 2013, which is where I want to stop again. But let's look at some of the inflection points, up in the relationship. During this period of China's very robust reform and opening, across the 80s and then again in the 90s and maybe into the first decade of the 21st century, how would we, if we wanted to just sort of hit the highlights of the DPRK-PRC relationship in those years?
I think, you know, the one flashpoint or the turning point in the PRC-DPRK relations, that would be 1992. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm saying that is there's several events happening in that year. So first of all, if you look at the domestic politics in China, so this is the time they have this 14th Party Congress.
Right.
And so in China, they revise the party constitution. So every time you read the party constitution, it's kind of a boring document. But if you really read it very closely and see what kind of terms they were put into the document and what taken out, that'll be give you this indications of anything happens there.
Sure.
So the term I'm interested in is internationalism, because the term itself shows the way China look at the world and look at where China is in the world. So basically before 1992, China had this internationalism inside the party constitution. And basically that sent a message saying that China is a revolutionary force trying to unite the global working class against global capitalists. But in 1992, when they redo this the party constitution, they took that word out. And in its place, they put in a peace and development. So, which is quite an interesting thing, because it basically tells the world that China no longer see, you know, class conflict and class struggle as the driving force for the human history. And instead, China see, you know, how to coexist with the capitalist powers, right? And to get, in the Chinese cases, to turn them into China's trading partners, the United States and South Korea, that is even more important, right, for the global global revolution. So now they use the party constitution to document that change. So that's the domestic politics. But if you look at the PRC-DPRK relations, China has a top-level visit with North Korea to celebrate the 80th birthday of Kim Il-sung, which is, you know, this has happened right after the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And so for Kim Il-sung, he is trying to organize the remaining progressive parties in the world and the Communist Party in the world and try to reignite.
In quotation marks.
In quotation marks. To reignite this revolution. Okay, but the problem is China refused to sign, you know, this document saying that China want to be the leader. Okay, so this is a Deng Xiaoping's policy of maintaining low profile. You know, so that's, and then the same year, China and South Korea they normalized the relationship.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and Mao Zedong does a brilliant job setting that up. I mean, that's the dagger,
right into the heart,
the back of the heart. And you know, I think to some extent that. That did something that the relationships never recovered from. You know, that, I think it's important for people who aren't familiar with this history and relationship, the dynamics, to understand that was just such a fundamental betrayal, you know. And I mean, I've talked to North Koreans who will bring it up. I mean, it's definitely still part of the consciousness that at that moment, the China just sold them down the river,
right.
You know, and didn't even try cross normalization, which was always the plan, right? If China normalized with South Korea, then you get the U.S. to normalize with North Korea. There's at least some kind of parity. No. China just does
unilateral.
Its thing. Right. And this is fresh post Cold War. Everyone's, you know, trying to figure out where they land. And so that one's still felt.
So there's another big event in 1992, of course, also, which was the Nanxun.
Yes. Right?
So Deng Xiaoping basically revitalizing, recommitting to Hu reform with his tour of the southern provinces. And so how does this, I was trying to get to this before, you know, the attitudes about economic reform in China and how it's been such an object of resistance. I know that, for example, you know, I guess it was just last year that Kim Jong-un's half-brother was killed. I mean, he'd already been on the outs, as far as I understand it, because he was an advocate of sort of Chinese-style reform. Correct me, but I mean, that's the impression that's been given. That's a tough case.
I'd be careful about linking that too closely. But
okay.
I'll start on this, and Mao Zedong can add. In terms of North Korean views of China's economic development, I remember looking, this is a while ago that I looked at this, but it's one of these, you know, there's a wonderful trove of documents from the Soviet and East European archives that pertain to discussions about North Korea. So it's a lot of how you can do the diplomatic history. And the Wilson Center has this amazing website that puts it up. And I think it's in that collection where there's a very interesting conversation. Kim Il-sung is talking, who's he talking? Maybe to Honecker in East Germany.
Eric Honecker.
And so this is like late 80s. You know, I think it's pre-Tiananmen, but already the model is apparent by that point. And he uses this phrase saying to East Germany, we're sticking with socialism, but those Chinese are betraying it, you know, and they're going down the capitalist road. So again, there's this notion of we're the center of this thing, you know, we're carrying on the project. And so I think that goes into the post-Cold War period. We can get to it. I think it's quite fundamentally different now, and that's very important for people to understand. But Kim Il-sung and then Kim Jong-il, I think they really hold on to a socialist, centralized, you know, kind of the Soviet model economy, despite all the evidence, domestic and international, that it's failing them. They stick with socialism.
Debate within the North Korean elite about this? Surely there were some people who would have been seduced by the Chinese successes, even, you know, the visible, you know, early as late 80s.
I think, first of all, I'm not doing the North Korean elite politics. So, and also, this whole system in North Korea is extremely opaque, right? Yeah, so it's just so hard to say there's any internal debate or discussion over this.
Sure.
But I think is what we can say is they tried, and smaller, you know, a bigger reform and trying to get their economy back on foot. And the problem is, first of all, it's too late. You know, it's this is a different world right now. And secondly, is I think they understand that you know, their country is getting to will be very vulnerable if they do anything differently. You know, so
yeah,
you're starting something fundamental change.
And we're leaving out all the security stuff that's going on at the same time, right?
Yeah, let's you know, maybe cover that quickly.
Well, just to jump in here with the fact that. How is Deng able to do what he's able to do, you know, to switch from power to wealth, is because 64, China gets a nuclear weapon, you know, and develops that program. Sure. So they have that kind of basic deterrent that the North Koreans now say they have. And to some extent on the basis of that, Mao makes the breakthrough with Nixon, right? And so China now has a weird kind of security guarantee from the Americans mm-hmm. and that relationship. So North Korea lacks all those things. I think at some fundamental level, the reason that North Korea is not ready in this period
is the security context.
Can't focus on prosperity and opening up and the risks that entails, because at a basic level, they lack the security of their regime, their borders, their sovereignty.
Right. You have to have the power before the wealth.
I mean, if I can jump in. So, to talk about this security concern for North Korea, I mean, this is a quite apparent, because if you just look at the map of the world, you know, you will see Korea as the good example of this country at the crossroads of empires, right? I mean, so look at the map. You will see Russia to the north, and then China to the west, and then Japan to the east, and then America's everywhere.
Right. Don't forget South Korea.
Right? And South Korea, right? That's just a proxy. I mean, you will see, this is a country surrounded by all these big powers,
sure.
Right? I mean, so they have all these powers at some point can be a source of help, right? I mean, they can give you the military assurance or give you an economic aid, but they can turn against you, right? I mean, so you see the Korean War, and basically this is a government almost destroyed by the war, right? So that's why, to go back to John's point, you know, this security concern is always there.
Paramount.
Yeah. Right, it's paramount.
Hi there, Seneca listeners. It's time for me to talk about one of my favorite subjects again, food. The good people at HelloFresh have sent me another delivery of meal kits. As you may know, I'm the main cook in my family, and I spent long enough in China that I now see making food for my family as the most masculine and macho thing I can do, aside from lift heavy weights or becoming a ninja. Or maybe developing a sword collection to rival Kaiser's. Anyway, I don't have a lot of time to shop for groceries, to cook, to feel manly. I've got a website and daily newsletter to edit, podcasts and videos to record every week, and a high-energy group of colleagues who keep me on my toes. So HelloFresh is perfect for people like me, who like to cook, but don't have time. It's a meal kit delivery company that offers three different plans: classic, veggie, and family. Last time they sent a package, my and my kids' favorite, was Mushu pork tacos. This time they sent chimichurri chicken paya, sweet as honey chicken, and some very nice hamburgers. You can choose the delivery day for each meal. You can pause the account if you go out of town, and each meal costs less than $10. They typically take about half an hour to cook, and the kits come with exactly the amount of each ingredient that you need, and super easy instructions. The great thing about these kits is that even if you cook a lot like I do, it is very easy to get stuck in your own cooking comfort zones. These kits make it easy to make a new dish with step-by-step instruction cards and exactly proportioned ingredients. If you need to cook good food fast with no fuss, please visit HelloFresh.com and support us by entering promo code SUPCHINA30 for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. Now, on with the show.
Majal, your paper that I referenced earlier, you point to a period of very rapid deterioration of relations in 2013. It's just ahead of the commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the armistice. So what was the significance of the fact? Let's just look at, I mean, I think it's telling that China did not hold any commemoration for the 60th anniversary of the armistice. They had done in previous years, but none at all on the 50th anniversary.
The 60th anniversary.
The 60th anniversary, right.
I mean, there's several things going on. First of all, you see definitely the generational change of Chinese leadership. So before that, you still have either the Yan'an or the revolution veterans. They were in their positions, and or the people who participated in the Korean War, and so they were in power. So that create some kind of human connections and people-to-people connections between the leaderships. But since Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, this is a post-war generation of Chinese leaders. So you don't have that kind of personal level exchanges at all. And also China is moving, first of all, we call them the post-revolutionary politics. Mm-hmm. And so not just China abandoned this whole notion of internationalism, but also China got into this kind of breathtaking economic reform. So, United States has become the leading trading partner with China. And South Korea has very close connections with China in a range of economic and geopolitical issues. So, and then China is trying to project its own both the hard power and soft power on the international stage. So when you have a regime like North Korea as your ally, and it just looked bad for Chinese government. Yeah. So.
I always looking for the right metaphor for the way that Chinese people, the average sort of educated elite in China now, thinks about their erstwhile maybe North Korean ally, the problematic one. I mean, was it that pit bull that got bitey that used to be kind of proud of its pugnacity, but now, or is it that little brother, that maybe developmentally challenged little brother who is sort of very large and good in a fight? And what's the right metaphor here? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, what does the average now, the average Chinese elite, how do they regard it? I mean, you started off talking about, this is a podcast, talking about how sort of ordinary Chinese people had regarded North Korea in the past. What about now?
Well, it's very interesting to see all those derogatory terms used by the Chinese in the 1950s, they'll come back. And for example, the Gaoli Bonds or Korean thugs, and so this is how, in part, this is a racial slur.
Yeah, it is.
But at the same time, it just show Chinese, they just dislike Koreans, or maybe North Korea in particular.
And I think, especially in this recent period, the feeling is mutual.
Yeah, that's no question.
And North Koreans, Kim Jong-un's attitude is very clear towards Xi Jinping. And I think we can see that reflected more broadly. I mean, it sends a signal to everyone, you don't have to hold back anymore. You can talk about how you hate the Chinese, So this is fascinating to watch, that sort of both sides. And these are both authoritarian states at a minimum. But I think one thing we've all learned, David Hume points it out, is even an authoritarian state is subject to public opinion in certain ways, yeah. Right? And sensitive to public opinion. And so this development's very important. I mean, the longer this goes, the deeper, the wider it spreads, where both the Chinese and the North Korean publics, have this disdain, this animosity, the way they look at one another. That has intense ramifications, and I mean, to jump ahead a little bit to some of the diplomacy of this year, frankly, it's an opening. It's an opening for the United States and for South Korea, at least if we look at it from a North Korean perspective, because they are so far out on the line away from the Chinese right now. They're kind of out there saying, pick me up.
So you've been in the media talking about this before, but I don't feel like this message is sinking in. I feel like people don't.
I gotta say it on CNN when my kids walk in the door behind me.
Exactly. That's what you gotta do. You gotta set that up and have them
stage it.
Have your wife at the ready.
No, it's frustrating. I mean, people don't. The American conversation about our topic, the China-North Korea relationship, has been so fixated on gotta get the Chinese to increase the pressure. They're 90% of the economy. If China would just shut it down, then we can get denuclearization, And that message, I mean, there are some elements to that are fine, but it's a very one-dimensional understanding. And that's all you hear just over and over and over again without understanding, I think, some of the stuff that we're getting at in this conversation.
So in the time that we have left, I really want to focus now on the substance of this paper that you wrote, which was just fascinating. When you look at the PRC founding myth, I mean, I think you talk about this in your paper, one of the pillars of it really is the war to aid Korea and resist America, right?
Sure, yes.
I mean, along with things like land reform and along with things like, the campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries. But this is now kind of irrelevant revolutionary anti-imperialist baggage that actually weighs down on China. It's a bit like how they're trying to wrestle with Mao. They want to divest him of all the ideological crap, but they recognize he's still very much a load-bearing wall, right? And you can't just knock it down. So you mentioned in your paper, Zhao, that the one national museum of the Korean War in Dandong, which was renovated in 1993. Again, this is interesting, 93, that's the 50th anniversary. It completely softened the whole tone, not just on the Korean War, but also on the U.S. That couldn't have gone down well. And then you have this paper about The Unforgettable Victory, which is this 12-part documentary series that aired in 2013, just some months after the actual commemoration date. So tell us very, very quickly about this documentary and what's so significant about it.
Well, first of all, the documentary film is the only, let's say, example of how China commemorated this war, or if at all, you know, at that point, because right around the 60th anniversary of the armistice, and all major parties in the war, they all held some kind of ceremonies to commemorate this significant historical event, but China only just released this documentary film, and so
and not even on the date, right? It was like months later.
But that's the sort of Chinese calendar, because normally China remember the day or commemorate this day at the time to the Chinese volunteer army cross the border, not the day not the war erupted, armistice. So that's how they remember the war. But the interesting thing is, you see how they're trying to really redefine, like, give this war a purpose in the post-revolutionary period. Because as Kaiser, you mentioned that all this revolutionary frameworks of this war has gone during the reform era. And so, you know, it's no longer internationalism, no longer class struggle, no longer against the United States and South Korea. So, you lost almost a quarter million soldiers there. And so you got to find a way to define this, right? And so that's why they bring back this whole notion of a nationalism, you know, that your people suffered, or your people kind of make a sacrifice, not for supporting a communist ally, but you come back and you support it because, I mean, you are saving your own nation. So that's the whole new message of patriotism and nationalism. Huh. So that's the new framework to rename this war.
They've stripped out all the incendiary rhetoric. It's really interesting because there's this whole part where you talk about how they no longer refer to the South Koreans as running dogs or you know, imperialist lackeys or puppets. They no longer even call the U.S., you know, warmongers or war criminals or imperialist invaders. But that rhetoric had survived for quite a while. I mean, that's what was used still in talking about the war until when?
Well, that's for the at least until early 1990s.
Okay, that's what I thought. I was sort of put it in around that time. You know, I'm curious, how are the causes of the war now described? You know, there's kind of a careful neutrality in this film, but outside of this film, is it now commonplace when you look at the way that in the classroom, when they talk about the causes of the war, is this too stripped now of its anti-imperialist or revolutionary motivations?
Just give you a quick example. First of all, it's a very sensitive topic today because of the North Korean and China relations. And so we tried to have a conference in Shanghai back in 2012.
You're supposed to invite me to that, too.
Oh, sure, yes, I will next time. So because this is an international conference, so we need to get permission from the Ministry of Education. And so they just told us, no, you cannot have the conference in China. And because North Korea is a diplomatic issue, and the Korean War is a sensitive historical topic, and also you use American money and having conference in China, so there might be some not so good implications. You know, so that's still a politically sensitive topic.
So where's it going to be? Don't know yet.
Undisclosed location. On a
boat.
But another telling example is, if they don't talk about this in classroom in any extensive way, 2 years ago, they released a film they called 我的战争, My War.
Uh-huh.
And it's a movie and talking about this war. And so it's really interesting to look at this movie and to watch this movie and see they make no mention of North Korea at all. You know, there's only a split second there's a North Korean guide and showing the direction of the road and for the Chinese volunteer army. And just for that, you know, that's the only split of a second you see North Korea in the film.
Wow.
But this is a film about a North Korean, this is a film about a Korean war. So that's,
you know,
tell
I have
you
to say, it would be interesting. You might think about doing some comparative stuff with the U.S. because I'm just thinking of some of course, the Korean War is known as the Forgotten War in the U.S. When it is remembered, where there are books about it or movies, just some things I'm thinking of, South Koreans are just a backdrop. I mean, they're like, there's trees, you know, and snow, and South Koreans too, and it's mostly an American unit the humans, the individuals, all are Americans. I mean, I think you could find interesting parallels between the way historically over time, North Koreans are just kind of the backdrop, or they even fade away from Chinese memories and representations of the Korean War. And Americans actually do the same with South Korea. I mean, now there's this big narrative. Obama was into it. Trump does it too. Thanks to the Korean War and the U.S. commitment, now there's this wonderful place, South Korea. But the actual war itself is kind of told and represented as Americans fighting, you know, and South Koreans are usually not there.
I think that I grew up watching MASH,
yeah,
not even really contextualizing it at all. I mean, it basically had nothing to do with the actual war. I mean, of course, it was intended to be sort of a parable for Vietnam.
I mean, just look at the title of the documentary I'm talking about, this Unforgettable Victory. You know, it's kind of the same, in the same line with the American reference of the Korean War as the Forgotten War.
And so, we talked about, remember, I think President Obama commemorated some site here, some new Korean War something museum, mm-hmm, or something, and Memorial his speech site was called like the Forgotten Victory, mm-hmm, that and Obama talked about how we call it the Forgotten War, but actually we forgot the great victory we won for this wonderful place, South Korea. You know, so there's strange parallels between the great power.
They both call it a victory.
It's very strange because on the one hand you see how China, you know, moving away from revolutions, trying to depoliticize or
demobilize. That was a really interesting word you used. They're demobilizing the viewers, right?
Right, right. But at the same time, you know, you see the American, especially after Obama's speech at the Korean Memorial in 2013, actually America is trying to mobilize, you know, this emotions among Americans to talk about this war as a way, you know, you see a democracy and a prosperity in the Korean Peninsula. And so that's an interesting contrast to see the two countries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very interesting. So John, or both of you, I mean, I'm sure you've both paid a little bit of attention to that. So that film came out in 2013, and so, you know, in the 5 years since, how have media representations of North Korea changed, especially since the nuclear crisis has been, you know, hotting up since 2015?
One development has been, it's linked to the whole big thing you obviously know a lot about, Kaiser, of kind of the Chinese netizen, you know, and all the ways in which voices online, you know, have shaped some of the politics, some of the foreign policy. I would say North Korea has been one realm where, you know, we talked about, Anjao talks about controls on academic conferences, but I can also point to a lot of examples of how the debate on North Korea has been one of the most open foreign policy debates over the last 5-6 years in a Chinese context. You know, there are a few examples like Deng Yuan, this guy who went too far and kind of lost his position. But, you know, they're relatively mild. And for the most part, I've watched this because I know a lot of these academics. And the room to say a bunch of different things about North Korea is really wide. And
it is deliberately so.
Correct.
This is not omission. This is deliberate. This is quite, I mean.
And so so that's at the elite stratum and kind of the foreign policy establishment. But there's another manifestation of that at the public, you know? And so, again, occasionally it gets shut down, like it's too much of the Fatty Kim third or whatever, but there's a lot of that out there, you know?
And
the party's not going to great lengths to sort of stop that and control that.
And that is so significant, right? Yeah.
Right, but I think, you know, we need to also look at the foreign policy world in China. I mean, Deng Yuan and even Shen Zhihua himself, you know, they are not necessarily the official voice of Chinese foreign policy. You know, these two, they are tend to be radical, and they have radical view of the PRC and DPRK relations. And I mean, overall, because this is the reason why I'm saying this is because, you know, I work on the regular basis with Chinese news media. And so when I write an op-ed, and so they would tell me, you know, no North Korea, because this is a highly sensitive issues. But I think starting later last year, and they start commissioning me to write articles about North Korea. Hmm. So that's kind of opened up the in a more public forum, you know, to talk about North Korea. So I would see that as a sign of maybe something going on there in a high level.
So I think this dovetails really well with the question. So we've got a new feature. We're asking our Access members to contribute questions that they can actually have asked on the air. And this one actually comes from somebody who I believe you know. He's one of your students, Noah Weber. Okay, so he asks, so in America, the Korean War is sometimes referred to as the Forgotten War, as we've just talked about. It's sandwiched between the two more memorable conflicts of, you know, World War II and Vietnam. So in the Chinese context, does the broader historical narrative, you know, of Kang Ri Jianguo tend to overshadow the Kang Mei Yuan Chao, or does the Korean conflict receive attention? And if it does receive attention, is it in media? Or is it in education? Where is this concentrated?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the Korean War or the Kang Mei Yuan Chao, it used to be one of the most remembered war in PRC history. Because again, back to Kaiser's previous comments, this is one of the three
pillars.
Yeah. You know, in that really it's the founding myth of PRC, right? So you look at the land reform. This is basically set up the economic system, and then this the suppression of counter-revolutionaries. This is a political consolidation.
Right.
So here we have the Korean War that kind of really set the tone for Chinese foreign policy for the next 30 years.
Yeah, not being bullied anymore.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So for both nationalist and internationalist reasons, right? And so, but now, you know, it's getting really difficult to talk about this war. So we start seeing. Maybe here's one thing to I just encourage everybody to go to see the new the renovated Korean War Memorial in Dandong, and it's going through a 3-year renovation, and it's supposed to open sometime this summer. And so you will see the physical
sign. I hope they keep
sign.
That diorama. I would be really sad if they got rid of that thing.
I love how the historiography is so easy to parse in China just when, you know, they build this museum. I mean, it's great. It's like, okay, I got it now.
You know, we can do a Seneca field trip because then
exactly.
We have to go. Because the North Koreans redid their history museum.
You got a date, man.
So we can combine them.
I'll bring the mobile rig and we will do that. That would be
nice.
Great. So we've got one more question. This comes from Clay Hedges, and it's specifically for John. So he asks, I would like to return to a period last year when China was offering its double freeze compromise to de-escalate tension between the U.S. and the DPRK. Just so that for those who don't know, the double freeze would be you freeze nuclear weapons development and at ballistic tests in exchange for a freeze of the U.S.-South Korea joint exercises that are conducted every year. And this is something that China's pushing. And so he asks, first, why didn't the compromise receive more consideration from Washington? Was it simply because it was proposed by China and would be seen as ceding too much global leadership to China? Or was it that foreign policy hawks were in the ascendant in Washington and they would reject any compromise involving U.S. military forces? Or was it something else entirely?
Okay, good question. I would say something else. So the freeze idea, first of all, the South Koreans were pretty lukewarm about it, and the Americans were negative. You know, there's something a little bit sacrosanct about these military exercises. And so there's some fixed thinking, like we just can't touch that. If we touch that, it means we're abandoning South Korea, and before we know it, Kim Jong-un will invade. I mean, there's literally some of that stuff out there, right? So,
and I mean, you speak of that a little contemptibly. Like you don't believe that
with,
is
with
so.
Deep content,
okay.
Yes, contempt. Okay. It is not so, but it's a real. I understand the people who believe that truly fear that. So there's a fear to tweak the exercises or suspend the exercises because of this notion that, you know, if you do that, the whole thing kind of comes falling down. Another reason, your questioner, I agree with one premise. There was, and in fact, I was a little suspicious of the freeze proposal because it came from China, simply because of the stuff we've been talking about, the Chinese are not talking to the North Koreans. Mm. So it's one thing if it's a coordinated offer.
Right.
And
there was no reason to believe that this would work, would be accepted by North Korea.
On the contrary, there's reason to believe China wants a freeze, but North Korea may want something quite different.
It's called a win-win for China.
Right, exactly.
We no longer have these exercises taking place right off of our...
Right, and Russia, you know, also was very happy with the freeze. So it's kind of happening right now. The joint exercises happened, but they were delayed, you know, suspended, delayed for the Olympics was a kind of big deal. They're happening next month, but they'll probably be toned down. In fact, there was a very funny editorial just the other day in I think, Renmin Rabao, Whereas it was the Chinese saying, like, this is, we said everyone should do this. Right. You know, we said freeze, freeze. And we said then you should have peace talks and denuclearization talks. Maybe, and that's what this summit is. So we should
like
get
that
credit.
Didn't it kind of look like it to you, though? I mean, it was redolent of freeze, freeze?
Yeah. But what's funny is what we're watching now, I call this the Chinese exclusion anxiety. You know, and there's a Japanese version of it too, phobia. They're really afraid. They want, it's also getting what you prayed for. The Chinese have been saying to the Americans too, you got to talk to the North Koreans. You know, if you want to deal with this thing, you got to talk to the North Koreans. Now we're looking at the prospect where the Americans start talking to the North Koreans. Yeah, the Chinese say, don't talk about us. Well, we need to be there too. Yeah, like, come back to the Six-Way Talks. So it's quite interesting to watch this play out.
Majal, John DeLurie, thanks very much for taking the time. Fascinating
topic.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Before we pack up here, let's make some recommendations for our listeners. But before we do that, I do want to remind our listeners that the Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out our free daily email newsletter, or better still, subscribe to our SubChina Access membership for just $8.88 a month, or $88 a year, to enjoy discounts on our events, premium content, membership on our private Slack group where you can ask questions like the ones that you just heard. It's a marvelously lively place for discussion too. If you enjoy the Seneca Podcast, please do go and leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes store. Means a lot, helps other people discover the podcast, so do it. Okay, on to recommendations. What do you, let's start with you, Majal. What do you have for us?
Oh, I think maybe two books. And at the level of elite politics, so there's going to be one book coming out from the Columbia University Press, A Misunderstood Friendship, Mao Zedong, Kim Il-sung, and Sino-North Korean Relations, 1949 to 1976. And then I'll just kind of shamelessly self-promote myself. You know,
it's a podcast.
Okay. Right. I mean, we have a lot of elite politics books, but I'm writing another book in A Seditious Voice in Revolutionary China. So we talk about how ordinary people react to the war campaign and how the middle-ranking officials, so they sold this notion of internationalism and China-North Korean relations to the ordinary people. So that's in the pipeline. And so hopefully it will come out quicker.
Great. Good recommendation. All right. I'm looking forward to reading the book too. John, what do you have for us?
Okay, so the one I have in mind is a Deng Xiaoping. This, you know, related to the paper I gave, been interested in the early Deng. And there's an interview he does with Oriana Fallaci.
Yeah, you talked about
that. Yeah, so I highly recommend everyone to go give that a read. You can Google it. You can read the Washington Post one comes up. Or there's various versions online. So it's accessible. And Chinese versions, too, of course, were published. There's a couple things about it. One,
what year was that again?
1980.
80, yeah. 80, right.
So one thing that's so striking about it is, first of all, actually, Fallaci herself, I think, could be an inspiration to journalists who are struggling with how to ask questions. It's a very combative interview, but she's combative. She asks incisive questions where she's really thought about the questions, but not to sort of corner Deng, you know, or trick him. I mean, she elicits really interesting answers. Uh-huh. So I think it's actually a model. You read these Trump transcripts and, you know, from the New York Times, and sometimes you're like, you guys, like, can you do your homework before you go in? You know, the notion of interviewing is just keep him talking, right? And now Xi Jinping would never sit
down for
right. So I think there's a message for both the journalists and the leaders of what a real interview should be like. That's part of it. But the other stuff is you got Deng just laying in on the importance of no more lifelong tenure.
That's Oriana Fallaci. Yeah. Oriana Fallaci is Fallaci.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. So highly recommend it. Very timely. Let's just say that.
Great. No, I'm definitely going to check out that interview. You know, I'm going to make a funny recommendations. I've been to quite a few conferences of the Association for Asian Studies, and I'm going to recommend that conference, even for people. I mean, it's
sure.
Just,
yes, I should have thought of that. Much off.
So impressed with how well this was organized, with the caliber of the people who showed up, how much fun that I've had here. I think that people who think of academic conferences as just, you know, these just insufferable nerd fests. There was
there's
actually there were a lot of fantastically interesting panels. With really good people, really high quality people. I've gotten into amazing conversations with people who are doing. Of course, this is a very target-rich environment for somebody who does a current affairs podcast on China. So there's that too.
Ducks but, in a barrel.
Yeah, exactly. Got them all. Yeah, fish or ducks. Ducks in a row.
Whatever
fish
it is. Whatever it is.
Yeah. So hey, thanks a lot, guys. That was terrific.
Thank you.
Yeah. Kaiser. Yeah. The Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/subchinanews and follow us on Twitter at subchinanews. I want to give a very, very special thanks to Madalika Kosika and to her absent husband, Jim Millwood, who's actually in Barcelona, for allowing me to invade their home and record 3 podcasts here. So thanks so much, Madalika, and thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.